Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Outthink the Classics. Before you start listening to this very in-depth but still enjoyable discussion of Dr. Seuss and separating the art from the artist, I just wanted to tell you that this is the last in our very first series of Exploring Evil, and I had meant it to come out in time for the holidays. However, the holidays got a holiday, so things happened, and we went in a slightly different direction with the podcast for 2024, but I am so, so grateful to my guests, Lauren Mazarese and Chill Kong. They just really went into this subject with such gusto, and they probably killed me that I used the word gusto, but really such care and compassion for the subjects that we were talking about, the people who really believe in Dr. Seuss, or used to believe in him, the people that were harmed by him, knowingly or unknowingly, and how to deal with it now. I especially really love the conclusion that Chill came to, which is that there is a museum of things that he has. And I'll wait for him to explain that to you. But thank you so much for being a loyal listener. I can't wait to explain all the cool things we're going to do in 2024, but you bet that they are going to revolve around developing critical thought for kids and families and the US election. Please follow Outthink the Classics wherever you listen to podcasts, and let us know over at outthinkmedia.com what I should review for you next. Enjoy. I used to have this vision of my favorite childhood authors penning their masterpieces in a colorful, inspirational space that resembles a playroom or a library storytime rug, rather than a stodgy office. After all, what could be more magical than to spend your entire day imagining wild characters, funny rhymes, and fantastical creatures who have a meaningful message to share? The reality, of course, is much more nuanced and often darker than we would ever imagine. Take Dr. Seuss, whose real name was Theodore Seuss Geisel. The fact is, he wandered into writing children's books, primarily because it was one of the only kind of writing that didn't conflict with his day job, which was advertising and editorial cartoons. He also found the reading primers of the day to be dull and boring stories with Dick and Jane. The short story might be summed up like so. For many years, Geisel made his living putting his signature silly characters into newspaper advertisements for bug spray, then oil companies, before moving into more freestyle editorial cartoons for a liberal newspaper called PM in the 1940s. Seuss also enlisted in the army and promptly paired up with other artists to create war propaganda movies. Although multiple characters that he drew in those newspapers, films, and many of his books were racist stereotypes, the aspect of his past that we touch on the most in this episode is his role in encouraging the general American public before and during World War II that Asians were our enemy, specifically Japanese Americans. In the 1950s, he retracted his views once he visited Japan, but the damage had been done. You can read more on outthinkmedia.com, and you don't need to know much more to follow my conversation with TV producer Chill Kong and licensed therapist Lauren Mazarese. It's an excellent episode to end this series on exploring evil, as we go into great detail to pick apart the definition of evil, our roles in evil acts, Seuss the man and Seuss the artist, not to mention our own feelings on the Grinch. So grab your headphones while my esteemed guests and I attempt to outthink the classics, giving families the historical and cultural context to decide which stories from pop culture have a place in our lives today.
So since the theme of this first series is exploring evil, we're going to start with that very simple question. How do you define evil? Now, Lauren, you gave an answer on episode one for The Wicked Witch of the West, so I don't know if it's adjusted or...
No, it's interesting because I went and I just listened to it just like a half hour ago, and it hasn't changed that much. And actually, a conversation I had with my husband last night, we got very much into how the sort of the moral aspect of the word evil and how does that actually exist? And when I outlined him some of the things we had talked about before, you know, all of the atrocities, he's like, well, those are acts. Yeah. You know, I don't know if I could label a person evil because there's so much that goes into what choices a person makes. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And then I listened to my answer from last time, which actually was exactly that, which is defining acts as evil. But the therapist in me then, of course, goes to, well, what environment was the person raised in? What trauma did they experience? What kind of abuse did they experience? What lessons did they learn? And what rights and wrongs were they exposed to? And so all of that just goes into, you know, a person and then making it much more difficult to define people as evil because we're just more complicated than that. So it was an interesting conversation. He was like, oh, no, I don't think I could decipher evil. But the moral implications were his hang up, I think.
Yeah, this is a complex question, right? Because and always, that's the funny thing, is the simplest questions tend to be the most complex. And I guess the way I look at evil is similar to Dante's Inferno, like the seven levels of hell, in that mm-hmm. at the core of it, there are people who are just evil. The morality, the actions, everything plays into that. And these are like the one percenters, right? Like the way we consider the people who just don't care. And I really do consider this question of evil as a part of care. Like if you do not care about other people, if you do not care about the implications of your actions, if you do not care about these things, then the act becomes evil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you care about these things and you act a certain way, it can still have kindness in it. But the second you remove that, it becomes now just a pure act of whatever selfishness or actions or something. So I don't have seven levels, but I have that, these one percenters who do the actions. But then I have the supporters. These are the people who do care, I guess is the word I would use, but they still do the action. They're the enablers. They're the ones that either believe what they see is right for whatever, the way they were raised and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next level is the bystanders, the people who watch, don't say a thing, what I consider a secondary consent due to inaction. It's just consent due to inaction, right? And then there's those who care, who then also act upon it, and then who rouse against what they feel is wrong. Now, that level is actually the grayest area of all levels because your philosophies, your biases, your racism, it all interacts in that. And there are lots of public figures who fall into that level, but also the worst ones, I think, are actually is the enablers, who inherently understand that this is wrong, that these people are evil, but they still mm-hmm. placate and still support because it somehow supports their ulterior motive, right? There's something that they want out of this, that this evil can get for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it could be selfish, it could be selfless, but those two, I think, are the worst. So that's how I would define evil in that sense.
Right. And that was about halfway to seven levels of hell. So,
yeah, exactly.
Not that far away. Yeah.
It is the more complicated ones that are interesting. It's very easy to say, for a very recent example, Henry Kissinger. Sure. I can't explain a single action. I can't. There's no justification ever in my mind. It's definitely the more complicated ones are the ones who do have some sort of enabling. I know, but I'm going to put the blinders on because my wants, my needs, what I need, that gets me to that end. That's definitely more complicated because then we go all the way down the line to the Jean Valjeans and the stealing of bread to feed my family, negative acts, but with a completely different kind of intent and who is actually getting hurt. And it's just, it's everybody in the middle.
That's the thing, right? Like even the, and I'm going to couch this way because it is my political beliefs and stuff, but like the wackadoodle anti-abortionists who run around mm-hmm. and then the really deadly ones who actually try to kill doctors, right? Firmly believe that they're in the right, that their actions will speak for themselves in heaven or whatever the hell they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a tough one to really suss out because it's like in their belief, their actions are supported by their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side, which is the rest of us, is what are you how can you kill in belief of life? Philosophically, that does not make sense, mm-hmm. right? But humanity doesn't make sense most of the time. I think that's the weird thing about this, is that we talk about evil, But logically understanding that word in a context of illogical human beings is really can be absurd.
So speaking about people, let's jump to one specific person.
But before we get into Dr. Seuss, please take a moment and listen to Julia Washington, who is our guest on Loki Part 2, as she tells you more about her own podcast, Pop Culture Makes Me Jealous.
Do you read a movie or TV review and wonder if you and the reviewer watched the same thing? I'm Julia Washington, host of Pop Culture Makes Me Jealous, and every episode my guest and I examine a different pop culture property, past and present, and how it impacted and influenced not only society, but us as well. We take a look at the reviews from the people that we are told we should be listening to and reflect on how that makes us feel, as well as do we agree with them? We've covered topics like My So-Called Life, When Harry Met Sally, and Bring It On. We dug deep into Ted Lasso and Monica Lewinsky and the Depp Heard trial. So if you have an ex or two like Jordan Catalano, rejected the notion that men and women can't be friends, or always rooted for the Clovers over the Toros and wondered why no one else did, then this might be the show for you. You can find Pop Culture Makes Me Jealous anywhere you find podcasts.
Dr. Seuss, his real name, Theodore Geisel. What would you say was your relationship with Seuss and how might it have changed through the years? Chill.
My relationship with him is complex because I've done a lot of theater. I've done a lot of family theater and I've done a lot of family TV. And so he is a very uniquely American children's icon. And I grew up with him. My son grew up with him. We still have his books. The problem is, don't meet your heroes. Don't. Because we're all flawed. Now, how do we deal with this flaw? Because the flaw is very specifically geared towards me and my face, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. He didn't like Asians. Didn't like them. And for a very specific period of time, he was adamantly trying to get people heated against Asians. And I know I say Asians, he says Japanese, I understand that, but try to explain the difference between a Japanese person and a Chinese person and a Korean person to anyone in the United States is like pulling teeth.
I'm not sure he would have bothered to stop and ask, what Asian country are you from? No. I don't think he would have.
There is like very actual connecting of the dots between his comics, his cartoons and newspapers and his outspokenness and the American idea towards internment. So, yeah, it wasn't limited to his art in that way. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing, too, is like he wrote this letter that, you know, sorry, not sorry letter.
Right. Yeah, he's good at those.
Where it's like, well, you know, it's the time. And I read that a couple times and I was just like, I had to read it in two contexts, which is he is a man of his time. That time, there was less information. Would he have sought them out? Probably not. The way he talks about it, he didn't care. He considered all that part of patriotism. In the same way, these, you know, January 6th people who consider themselves patriots don't care about how they're reflected. And they'll apologize for going there, but they don't really.
Right.
But they don't care, right? So my relationship with him has been really complex. And my shift is now I consider him in my museum of things.
Mm.
My museum of things can have lots of things. They're very complex, but it's a museum of things that has all of that information. Same thing with all our other artists that we know have done terrible things. I can still contextualize them and put them in the museum. Because they're essentially a historical figure in my head, they're not part of my active artistry, right? Mm-hmm. Before, he was a part of my active artistry. He was references when I was younger to things and how to write stories and lyrically and all that stuff. But once I discovered the impact that he's had within storytellers of the next generation from him. Once I put him in a museum, my whole relationship with him changed because now it's just a reference. He's only a reference. He has no impact on my artistry. He's just a part of history. Now I move forward with other people that are more current, that allows me to tell stories differently within context of now. Was he a part of my life? Absolutely. But It is a historical moment now. But it was really disappointing once I found out all this stuff. It was really hard. Because now, if my son does want to pull out the, like, I don't even let him, it's not even in the catalog now. I've pulled the books out from his access. Because now it is in a glass jar where all the other historical stuff is, right?
And that was similar to mine, where I was so excited to share Dr. Seuss with my kids. And then I pulled out The Cat in the Hat, which I don't think I had ever read before, and just felt icky. And just, this is not reading the way that I'm sure he meant it to read. And then I saw Seussical, and that was, there's a whole storyline about a bird taking pills and getting plastic surgery while she's abandoning her child. And it's like, that might be, you know, definitely expanded upon for the musical, but something was there that they grew with. Lauren, real quick, what is your relationship with Seuss?
Oh, God, it goes way back. My first book I ever learned to read was One Fish, Two Fish. And I think I still own every single Seuss book. And it was very important. When my nephew was born, I started getting him all of the books. And it was, I think, literally after I had given him the final book, I think it was that year they pulled the whole chunk of books off the shelves. And I was like, wow, okay. And he had been obsessed with If I Ran a Circus. It was the only one he ever asked me to read. So it was just like constantly only ever asked me to read that one. So he didn't get into a lot of the ones that had been pulled. For me, it was just language. I love language. And I would stay up all night long reading his books. I just love all the wordplay. He was just a huge part of my childhood and growing up. And then, yeah, the don't meet your heroes thing. It's just so hard. And part of me wishes, you know, it's, there are a lot of people around now who have done some really terrible things and are not apologizing for it. I'm like, okay, but you clearly have the opportunity. We've given you the opportunity to say mea culpa, like I did something wrong. Moving forward, I'm going to shift. And they refuse. You know, 25 years ago, interviewed Kevin Spacey. Fantastic, fascinating guy. One of the best interviews. I mean, it was such a conversation. I was like, this guy's brilliant. And it's, damn, yeah, okay. But the unapologeticness, and it's just like, well, what if he was still here? Would maybe if he had the opportunity? And it's like, yeah, he kind of had the opportunity. I mean, cancel culture, all of that wasn't really a thing before he passed. But again, then knowing how old he was, when he did grow up, when he came about, would he say, yeah, you know, right, okay, fine, something that's problematic. Maybe not. So then it becomes this sort of struggle to, do I look at the art, but not the artist? And it gets so messy.
So this is yet again, like a very nuanced thing. Mm-hmm. And what I consider like all those Kevin Spacey and Dr. Seuss and
Woody Allen, these stars.
Yeah, all these
them.
People.
Yeah.
They're in the same category actually as the Confederate flag to me.
Interesting.
It's like, it is a great reminder about history and what has happened, but it doesn't really have a place in the now. And I think that's the way I can contextualize this whole thing, because you can't deny that they're part of the past. You just can't. But what you can do is say, but they're part of the past, and then move on. And so I don't need to cancel it. I don't need to cancel him. I just need to stop talking about him. I think that's the beauty of, that's where power really does belong to the people that we just forget, is that the easiest way for us to stop all this nonsense is to stop it.
Right. As I stare at the other questions that are us talking more about it. And part of the intention of this is to not do cancel culture and whatever that means at the point, but to give families the context, right? Give them the concepts and the historical social context to then make their own decisions. Going a little bit back, it's always been interesting to me how to then explain that to children. I have no problem pausing something and talking about something, whether I knew about it beforehand or not, and trying to explain, I'm a little uncomfortable, but that's me. That's not necessarily something I want to put onto you or some of his works that maybe aren't as blatantly racist or anything. I'm curious about what your thoughts on talking to kids about this kind of topic, about this kind of person, when somebody else that brings it out of your museum of things or your nephew wants to keep reading that book.
That's a good question.
Well, look, for theater, like what prime example is, A Cat in the Hat does really well all the time. It's a simple idea. It's, and you talk about consent, but there are lots of bullying happening that is still done in a fun way that makes it entertaining. And that's a problem. What I'm finding is that as long as you fill in the context before they see the show and then see it from those eyes, you can then adjust and make little changes within the way you present the show, present that story that is at least accepting the idea, right?
Right.
That there's no consent here. So how do we talk about this here? This is why things like live theater, things that allow you to discuss things afterwards, I don't mind them being presented as long as there's context. Same thing with Mikado or Gilbert and Sullivan.
Right.
Those, the idiots that would just want to perform the zany musical that they remembered in high school, okay, yeah, they lack any artistry anyway, and they just want to put up stuff because they like their Confederate flag, they just want to wave it, right? They're the idiots. And they're going to exist no matter what. It's the smart ones that doesn't just wave it, but then actually present it and go, this is the history of the flag.
Right.
That to me makes sense. I don't mind it existing as long as it is with a giant plaque that says, this represented racism in these multiple forms. Then I know. That's the problem I have with all these like statues being disappearing. Okay, take them off. That's great. Put them somewhere where we can use it as part of history.
I don't want to salute it, but I would like to learn about it.
Yeah, why. Put it in the museum. Yes,
because why did we have it? Why? Because otherwise we don't learn about the why, then we'll just do it again.
Yeah.
And with the cat, I was just going to go back that second. What you were saying about the cat in the hat and consent and how you can do it while asking new questions, right? And it's not just face value. I was just reading a thread on Baby It's Cold Outside.
Right.
And it said the holiday rape anthem. And then someone was posting about the married couple that wrote the song. And in context of the time, she's not asking, did you put something in, what's in this drink? People used to say, oh, what's in this drink? It's just a casual question because it was a delicious drink. And like hearing what the couple had to say that wrote the song had to say about it. In context, it's much more of a song about a woman who really wants to stay, but everybody's going to talk badly about her if she does stay, but she wants to, and she's coming up with a list of reasons why she shouldn't, because everybody's going to think that I'm a slut if I stay over, but I really
I
want to.
I have no internal monologue changed. Like that. I never, ever.
You're right.
The Mikado is another example of that, is that the original intent wasn't to mock Japan. The original intent was to mock the reigning British folks. It was intended to mock the napkin holder and all these pristine royalty. It was intended to mock them. But what has happened is, like all things, lazy artistry. And I attribute most of our problems within taking an old piece and redoing them to lazy and actually terrible artistry.
Mm-hmm.
The people who want to create museum pieces, like I said, I put these things in a museum. They're the worst of the artists in our world because they are not creating anything new or in doing it to the original intent of the piece. They're doing it just because they love the silly slap, all the racism in it. They love that. And so they would rather point to that because it is easy, it is cheap, and honestly, because they're stupid. They're just not smart enough to see the details.
Yeah.
And so when I hear these arguments from these people, I immediately know, oh, you're dumb. You don't even know originally what this piece was done for. So my arguments with them becomes very different. Now I just go, then it's me just informing them, that this was intended this way. And they just go, that's when they get caught. They realize, they didn't even do the research. They don't really love this piece like they say they love it. And this is when I get to how I get that discussion happening. Once I understand that you're the idiot artist, right? Then now I'm just educating you. And by the time once they're educated, they start understanding, I understand why you may not like it. They'll still do it. These lazy artists are the worst of us. And there's a lot of them. That's the problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who will support it because they're lazy and they would rather keep these old museum pieces than learn something new.
I grew up with Gilbert and Sullivan. They were basically my childhood playmates. And I do feel lucky because my father would always explain, this is meant as satire against Parliament and things like that. But it really is pretty evident, like you said, about when somebody is just being lazy.
And I think that art should be allowed to evolve at the same time. Like with the Baby It's Cold Outside, the thing is it does read like the Cat in the Hat. It does read like grooming children at this point. And while you can address it in context. You can read The Cat in the Hat and you can say, okay, this is how it was meant. It is also true that, like, the world changes. I don't necessarily believe that art is just stagnant. I think that it is breathing, and I think that it can shift over time and its meaning and what we get from it. So the fact that it reads like a date rape song, the fact that The Cat in the Hat reads like grooming children, we can't ignore that either. And so does the moral of the story shift because the world has shifted? Yeah, maybe. So can somebody listen to a dozen versions of Baby, It's Cold Outside and love every one of them? Sure. Great song to sing. It lays right in my range. Love it. At the same time, you want to understand, like, how you read some of the lines. Like Dean Martin, some of the ways that he sang his lines felt much more date rapey than somebody else does. And so apparently there's a great Alan Cumming, Liza Minnelli version where they halfway through flip parts.
Yes.
So doing something like that where you can give it new life, I think that, I don't know, I think there's something to be said for that with The Cat in the Hat, with some of his other works like The Lorax, and mm-hmm. being able to ask more complicated questions about it. Maybe there is still a place for some of that.
Yeah, and one thing that was interesting I really found when my kids started watching TV more and like really seeing it was that they had a Cat in the Hat TV series and changed one of the first things that bothered me about the book, which is your mother will not mind at all if you do, which is a refrain, a very constant refrain in the book. But then he says, but good, let her know where we're going. And so it's clear that somehow, obviously, these are two now stay-at-home mothers, which that's a whole other topic, but they have some kind of relationship with The Cat in the Hat and understand that he's not going to leave them up in whatever clouds they go to. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other smaller things that they did that I think were good choices.
Thing is, everything within context and adapted to the future can make sense. Doesn't mean it's right. And how you start looking at the ethics of this becomes this really fascinating gray area where a talented artist can make that shift and hit the right tone. But it will take a talented artist to go into the museum of history and stupidity and pull it out with new context. And that's what we strive for. We want artists who are like that. We want artists who can take and remix and re-DJ it out so that the song feels better and the move feels right. And that's where artistry really becomes this magical transformation of museum pieces. But really now I'm looking for more transformative things that are current and based out of our stories now. Now it's more about like looking back at the museum as a reference, but not as a source material. Right.
Right.
That's the distinction now.
I always find too, like when they did pull those 4 or 6 books, that's when I really understood hearing people's arguments for not doing it, that it wasn't even about the book. At that point, it was about the fact that they have good memories reading it, or they have good memories reading Seuss, and they felt that we were saying they had bad taste or couldn't see it or are racist or whatnot, when in fact, they are also part of that context and in that time, whatever that means. It's been interesting to try to think of it like that, where whenever I do run into somebody who uses cancel culture in a very flippant way.
It's interesting that you said that, because there was one of the books that got pulled. I think it was Scrambled Egg Super, was my absolute favorite as a child. I just loved the refrain, Scrambled Egg Super Dee Duper. I remember the whole thing. But as a little girl, of course, the racism didn't scream at me. Why would it? It was not a world that I was exposed to. It didn't occur to me. Wouldn't have known. So when I also had not probably read the book since I, because that wasn't one that my nephew liked. I got it for him, but it wasn't one that he loved. So we never read that one. Probably hadn't read it since I was like 12. And I also didn't remember those parts. I just remembered the colors of the eggs. I always remembered how I loved the colors of the eggs. That's what I remembered about that book. And so I remember my response when that one was one of the ones that got pulled. I think it was that one. Oh, no. Because for me, that's what was getting pulled from the shelf, was that like child memory that I have of the eggs. I just remember like the red with the white dot. I can still remember. And I went back and read it because I still have that book. And I'm like, oh, yes, that is very problematic. I read that now as an adult. I'm like, holy crow, that's not okay. But when I first heard, I was just like, no, that's my favorite. And so, yeah, when you said that to me, I was like, I think that is something that I can definitely relate to, while also then stepping back and recognizes I'm not 12. I do know the context. I do know a bigger story, and I can put this book down now.
Well, that's the problem with nostalgia, right? It's is that people fight for nostalgia, like tooth and nail for it, because it represents something. But here's the problem is that nostalgia in conjunction with fairly racist ideology is what is harming people and what people are trying to fight against. But the problem is that they only feel and fight and rile against the nostalgia of hating. And that's what the way I see it as, right?
Yeah. And to go back to what you were saying the very beginning, Jill, about the morals, when we were talking about moralite, that it becomes tied into that. Like, how dare you? This is me. This is who I am. Instead of recognize, what about this thing are you going to miss? Is it the slavery that it represents in the Confederate flag? Or is it because your dad, who you loved because he was your dad, always had a tattoo of the Confederate flag, and that makes you think of your dad? And I'm like, let's try to help you as a therapist. I said, let's try to help you find other things that remind you of your dad, first of all. But recognizing, where is the actual connection? And can you now step back from that personal connection you have to this thing, whether it's an object or an art or a symbol or an idea, step back from it and see it in a larger context? Maybe, I don't know, put on some empathy shoes and see it from someone else's perspective and how perhaps this also represents something very terrible to somebody else.
Yeah.
And then you can walk away with your personal connection and keep that, but understand that this is also, when we're talking about symbols, we're talking about art, we're talking about public stuff, but there are different ways to see them and they mean different things to different people. And it's a big deal, and to be able to have that. But then again, then we're talking about, it's not black and white. It's not a moral issue. Yeah. It's an ethical issue. And people are not good at that. We are not good at integrating opposites. I do it with clients all the time. I love you and I'm mad at you. It's so different than I love you, but I'm mad at you. It's integrating of opposites. And we are not good at that at all.
Which is why I love storytelling, is that you can integrate. You can integrate them.
Oh, yeah.
You can divide them in different characters, but you can integrate it in one story. Ooh. And you can even, you can have these references, these historical references in the story, and point at it. Like, one of my favorite things is there's this K-drama called It's Okay to Be Not Okay. The central character is this children's book writer, but she has this really great way of looking at old stories, like the Boy Who Cried Wolf. People are like, oh, he's coming out, he's saving people. And the way we assume that story is told. But what I love is this K-drama said, no, he does this, he cries wolf because he's lonely. Which just makes you go, oh,
yeah.
But he comes down from the mountain, because he's alone in the mountain. And so he does that because he wants attention. And so I love how you can now take a historical thing that could mean one thing and then look at it in a different way. And I think that's what I'm trying to find, is how do we take a look at these things in a different way that isn't asking them, but is just presenting them with something where they have to look at it a different way, where they have to look at it that way, right? That's the challenge as an artist, is that how do you do that? I think that's the fun part about trying to be out there and creating new stuff, is it, is incorporating all these things.
Let's move to a specific story now, since we're in the holidays and the Grinch has been appearing so ironically on displays for merchandise. Since Halloween. I walked into a Goodwill the week before Halloween and they still had all their signs up, but they had all their Christmas stuff underneath those signs. So I was really surprised, because last year I went on a bit of a rant. I know this will shock you as my Facebook friends, that I went on a rant on Facebook. Like, finally watched the new Grinch. I saw the one with Jim Carrey once. That was plenty. My whole point with it was that by giving the Grinch a sob backstory, even that he was bullied as a child, by giving him that backstory, I felt like it really cut down the whole concept of, and the whole theme of consumerism and capitalism, and gave him, I guess, a more external reason to be the Grinch than an internal one, which is what the backstories give. But what shocked me about that was that when I posted that, one of my friends was... he was arguing against me, and then all of a sudden we realized, oh, you don't think that the Grinch is anti-consumerism or anti-capitalist like I do. You saw him as the epitome of capitalism. And I still don't quite wrap my head around that, but I was just so amazed at the vast differences between our takeaways from it. And then another friend of mine recently said that for her, it was all about the loner and being lonely and ostracized, which I can definitely see. But I'm really interested in how you feel the Grinch may have morphed in meaning through the years, or the very fact, too, that when the Grinch was originally produced, it took a lot of effort to get Geisel to approve it. Mm-hmm. And a bank was the one that actually funded it.
The irony of that statement is hilarious. No, but like all things, the story has evolved in smaller details. And I do agree with you about the backstory, how sometimes a backstory can actually take away the power of what the character represents. Mm-hmm. And by explaining the behavior, you then excuse the behavior. And I agree in that way that he didn't need his behavior to be explained. His behavior is his behavior. What it did was you excused it. Now it's, oh, he's sad. So now it becomes about his behavior and not about the ultimate result, which is this community who came together and said, you know what? We didn't need all this stuff. Yeah. We're here. We love you all. And let's just celebrate what this really means. And I think it has lost its meaning, its initial meaning, because of good intentions.
Right.
Right.
Also, it just makes it easy. Yeah. Again, it makes it easy. He literally says, whatever the reason, it's in the text. Well, whatever it was, his head or his shoes, he stood on the hill hating the hoos. It doesn't matter what the reason was. Like, it's in the text.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. He hated them. And so I just feel like it's too easy. It's much more complicated. And sure, there's tons of reasons, but the whole point isn't why he was doing it. It's that he shifts. It's that he learns a lesson. Was he evil the whole time? I don't know that he was. We don't know. And it almost doesn't matter. What matters is the choices that we make in the end, how we decide to change, to shift the narrative, how we decide. He could have looked at the who's celebrating and being like, dumbasses, what are they doing? That's the most ridiculous thing. He didn't. Something shifted. And to me, that's what I always take away from it, is the people's ability to change their minds, people's ability to change their perspectives. And that's what happens at the end of that.
He reminds me of every cranky old Southern white dude on a lawn. That he just does. He could have been a war vet. And this is why he hates Asians. I get that. I'd hate me too if I was a war vet. You know what I mean? But the problem was is that when we shift these stories and its intentions, we shift the stories and its tensions. Like, you got to recognize that. Because I felt like it had more power when there was no reason for his hatred, because he saw these people with their dazzling lights and all these shiny toys. And I would look at that town too and go, look at these silly people and all the things that they spend on. Why would I want to be a part of that town? Once they shifted, once the town went, oh, you know what? We really didn't need all this stuff. That's when his heart grew. Not because he all of a sudden found kindness. He shifted because they shifted. And I think that's where we lost. We lost that idea that the town understood the value of love and community. And so instead, what it turned into with this explaining away his past was that because he suffered, he understood how to finally see their suffering. That felt like the way its story shifted to. And that's not it. The story's not that.
And also, I might debate the fact that they shifted at all. I have not seen anything outside the book or the original animation. They don't wake up being like, oh my gosh. They just wake up and sing the way they always do. So to me, in some ways, it's just maybe if he had gone down, he would have learned that they never needed things, but they loved them and they had them. So when they loved them and when they had them, they celebrated them. When they didn't have them, then they still celebrated what they... So I personally can't say, did the who's shift? Did they go through, did they all wake up and sit together and say, okay, you know what? It's okay that we don't have any things and everybody stole for us. Let's go out and sing. Because we don't see any of that. None of that is, you're like in the original material, none of that is there. Mm-hmm. We have no idea how they woke up in the morning. All we know is what the Grinch knows is that they came outside and sang anyway.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just who they are, these lovely, you know, Scandinavian types.
I'm with you because I think the better ending would have been if he brought all those toys back and the whole town said, and they said, you keep it. Take it back to your mountain. We don't need that. And then it ends with shots of them running out and throwing snowballs at each other and hearing kids laugh.
Right.
If he did that, yeah. Then it turned full circle. And it mm-hmm. still used his backstory to allow me to recognize that it wasn't about the backstory. It's about how we can all mm-hmm. just live together and be happy with what we have. That is just about us.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a better intent. But again, that's why it's like what I felt like the most recent Grinch story was, is good intentions about how we're trying to modify old stories without understanding the real intent of the original mm-hmm. story. But those good intentions are still good intentions, but it just comes off half wrong.
Him giving all the toys to Max, because sometimes that dog is the most well-developed story and the most well-developed character. And talk about kindness. Like, it wasn't Cindy Lou who may have made him stop a minute, but Max has been so nice to him the whole time. Anyway, I just had to give Max a little shout out because he was...
Yes, shout out to Max.
That's a great dog.
In the animated, I do like how it's not exactly like, it's fine, you can keep all that stuff, but it is like, come in, okay, no, share all this stuff. It's just, oh, but share this with us. Oh, thanks for giving it back. Now come and enjoy it with us. Please come and enjoy it with us. Now that we know you're not this scary person, come and enjoy it with us.
Yeah.
So hate to cut this off because I could obviously talk to both of you forever. But really, honestly, thank you so much. These are such nuanced and really wonderful discussions to have, I think. And I always come away with it aching to now go downstairs and connect with my kids and maybe explain a little bit more about why that YouTuber or that one video is not right for them. It will be in the show notes, but where can people find out more about you?
Mine is chillkongs, that's chillkong.com. And Mama Kong Says, so MomaKongSay.com. Both of those are different websites. It has everything currently that I'm working on.
And that's a wrap on the last episode of our first series, Exploring Evil on Outthink the Classics. My new podcast, where my guests and I give you the historical and cultural context to decide which stories in pop culture have a place in your life today. Thank you so much for listening to the end. Please check our show notes for resources and more reading on Dr. Seuss. We're going to prepare for season 2 now, when we'll explore love and relationships in kids' media. I'll also circle back to Dr. Seuss and Miyazaki to tell you more about their wives. They are some of the many spouses whose own ambitions took a back seat in order to support their partner. And here at Outthink the Classics, we think it's time they finally got their due. Please also subscribe and share the podcast with friends who you know would like it too. We can only grow with your support. And right now, you can share all 6 episodes of our series on Exploring Evil. This podcast was edited by Avi Klujanski, theme music composed by Adam Emperor Southard, and produced with CMJ Communications LLC, parent company to Outthink Media. I'm Cindy Marie Jenkins, creative editor of outthinkmedia.com, and we will see you back here